Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are Reclaiming the Republic. And we are still in the Virginia ratification debates. To think, we started this whole information campaign in providing you all of the details, or the highlights, I should say, out of the ratification debates. We started this March 29th. So you can see that we've gone 2 months in providing this much. And you know what? There's even more highlights. We've actually deselected some of the highlights of, you know, the process of impeachments and some of the other things that may have been of more interest in previous episodes, because it was all about impeachment and those types of things. So we provided the insights. I am just telling you that they went through every line of the Constitution. So as you look at what we're going through, I think you should have this feeling that the evidence is overwhelming. What the federal government can be doing and what they're doing is not what they're supposed to be doing. The paradigm of the relationship between the states and the federal government has been subverted by the progressives and by this communist movement that actually began in America in the 1800s. It's taken 100+ years to get to this point. And we are in the throes of a Bolshevik revolution. Now, I know that there's so many things that have popped in the past 2 months that have popped in through the news cycle. And I hope you're starting to recognize that there is nothing we, you, I, any of us can do regarding that news cycle. And the best thing that we can do would be affecting that news cycle by getting Republic Review. Just think. I mean, they have this plan of, you know, providing this level of information just to keep us preoccupied. Well, what it's kind of like Trump, how Trump used his Twitter feed to kind of redirect everybody so that, you know, they were engaging on the issues that they wanted to get engaged on instead of being able to control the narrative. Well, I'm telling you, once we kick off Republic Review, we'll be controlling the narrative. And when it comes down to the truth, when people really want to hear the truth, we're just going to point them to Reclaiming the Republic. We're going to point them to therepublicreview.org. As you know, this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. But what I am telling you is those of you who have been able to disengage from this, what I will call a porn addiction, this news cycle addiction of, oh, well, look what they're doing. Well, what about Trump? You know, those things are going to continue, and they're going to continue on and on and on to consume every minute of your day for the rest of your life, or at least until they have full control. Is that what you want? You want to let them have full control? I don't think so. And I don't believe most of America, I believe the majority of America is starting to wake up. And I know more and more people that don't even have a television and they don't watch the crap anymore. As you know, we have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And this is the only show that is going to give you the academic evidence as well as the academic evidence-based solutions. And I am here to tell you that if you look at D.C., there is no sign that they are ever going to relinquish any, even with Trump in charge. They will not relinquish any of their unconstitutional powers, which is the majority of the things that they're doing. So the only way we're going to get them back get the genie back in the bottle, or get them back into the framework of the Constitution, is through Republic Review. Auditing the Constitution and holding them fully accountable and forcing them to stand down, defund, and get rid of all of these bureaucracies, all of these buildings that they're occupying. As far as I'm concerned, they can rent them to anybody else. I'm going to tell you, once the federal government is back into the framework of the Constitution, lobbyists will go away, corporations will go away, because they can't knock on the door anymore, because the federal government will not be playing in their knickers and in their lives anymore. The states will be assuming the control, as they should be, over all domestic matters. As Madison pointed that out, that the federal government was outward facing, and that the states were basically the boss over the over the domestic matters, over the things that affect our lives the most. Now, when we departed in our last episode, we were going through John Marshall's comments regarding jurisdiction and so forth. And so we're going to get right back into that. And as a matter of fact, see, we're trying to be as efficient as possible so that we can cover as much of this that we possibly can and get through this. Anyway, so this is Mr. Marshall, and he, taking off from where we left off, what are the reasons for this supposition? Do they draw them from a manner in which the judges are chosen or the tenor of their office? What is it that makes us trust our judges? Their independence in office and manner of appointment, are not the judges of the federal court chosen with as much wisdom as the judges of our state governments? Are they not equal, or actually, so let's go back to what I was saying, because as we were talking about the court system and how the representation of the court system is not representative of the republic, it's a representative of an education system, it's representative of a political slant, an ideological slant, a religious slant. How, if you look, and I said this in the last episode, I proved this in my book, that the majority of those who are sitting on and in the federal court systems, especially the Supreme Court, most of them supported slavery. They were sympathetic to slavery. In other words, Southern states are those with Southern education, or those who at least had that paradigm. And that's why they didn't step in and say, hey, this Monroe Doctrine, that's unconstitutional. It was supported, and it was only proven later that it was unconstitutional. And that's sad, but that's how it is. And when he says, won't the federal judges be just as, judicious? No, I shouldn't say judicious. Won't we be just as discerning in making sure that our federal judges are just as good as our state judges? Well, hold on. What if all of the judges are coming from slave states? Won't they have a bias? It's not like each person that's going to be sitting in the Supreme Court, there'll be one person from each state. Does that make sense? And doesn't it make sense that if all along, the Supreme Court had one judge from each state, an abolition state and a slave state, you would probably find, because a good chance of Missouri, the judge coming from Missouri, it may be a slave state, but it would be an anti-slave judge, because most of the people in Missouri were anti-slavery. It was just those who had the money to set up the big plantations to exploit slavery in Missouri. Just so you understand, having representation and taking away the permanency of a position, in other words, now this means that they really have to perform instead of being able to go down these ideological slants and or become activist judges in driving agendas. You get caught driving an agenda, you're gone. Your job is to support the Constitution as defined by the states, or as defined to the states at the time of ratification. There you go. That's where we need to be. Anyway, back to John Marshall. Are they not equally, if not more, independent? If so, shall we not conclude that they will decide with equal impartiality and candor? If there be as much wisdom and knowledge in the United States as in a particular state, shall we conclude that the wisdom and knowledge will not be equally exercised in the selection of judges? Now, just like I said, put this in your pipe. if they knew which judges had a slant and or an affinity or even an agenda in supporting slavery and those types of paradigms, you stack a court that way, then all of a sudden justice and the outcome of court cases would go in a very specific direction and not based on the Constitution or the law. The principle on which they object to the federal jurisdiction seems to me to be founded on a belief that there will not be a fair trial had in those courts. If this committee will consider it fully, they will find it has no foundation and that we are as secure as anywhere else. What mischief results from some causes being tried there? Is there not the utmost reason to conclude that judges wisely appointed and independent in their office will never countenance any unfair trial? What are the subjects of its jurisdiction? Let us examine them with an expectation that causes will as be candidly tried there as elsewhere and then determine. The objection which was made by the honorable member who was first up yesterday, which was Mr. Mason, and actually that's what we read in our previous episode, is what Mr. Mason was basically saying, that, you know, can we trust these guys? Who are these guys? Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's start back with this. The objection which was made by the honorable member who was first up yesterday, Mr. Mason, George Mason, has been so fully refuted that it is not worthwhile to notice it. He objected to Congress having power to create a number of inferior courts according to the necessity of the public circumstances. I had an apprehension that those gentlemen who place no confidence in Congress would object that there might be no inferior courts. I own that I thought those gentlemen would think there would be no inferior courts as it depended on the will of Congress, but that we should be dragged off to the center of the Union. but I did not conceive that the power of increasing the number of courts could be objected to by any gentleman, as it would remove the inconveniences of being dragged to the center of the United States. I own that power of creating a number of courts is, in my estimation, as far as from being a defect, it seems necessary to the perfection of this system. After having objected to the number and mode, he objected to the subject matter of their cognizance. You know, I look at government and having all of these government spots all over and these huge court halls and everything else. I believe that everything needs to, we need to move our government far more into a virtual and into more transparency, because we can do that. We don't have to have back rooms anymore. We need to force our politicians and those who are public servants to be in the eye of the public always, except for, you know, when they have to use the, you know, the facilities or something like that. Anyway. So at this point in time, Mr. Marshall then reads Section 2 of Article 3. These, sir, are the points of federal jurisdiction to which he objects, with a few exceptions. Let us examine each of them with the supposition that the same impartiality will be observed there as in other courts, and then see if any mischief will result from them. With respect to its cognizance in all cases arising under this Constitution and the laws of the United States, he says that the laws of the United States being paramount to the laws of the particular states, there is no case but what would extend to. Has the government of the United States, now listen to what he's saying here, because this is the one part where Marshall actually spoke to the accuracy of the power and jurisdiction of the Constitution. I want you to understand that later on when we start reading some of Marshall's rulings, and I'll give you what those rulings are so you can go off and read them, you will see how Marshall actually contradicts what he says right here. And he says, has the government of the United States power to make laws on every subject? No. They can't make laws on energy, on education, on religion, on they can't make it on every subject. So he's basically asking, you know, an outlandish question to basically prove the absurdity that the courts are going to be going down all of these paths of equal absurdity, of chasing jurisdiction or chasing powers and or usurpations of powers. As we look at, you know, the education system, the housing, labor, and all of these usurpations, well, yeah, the court chases those because those are unconstitutional. They're all in league with each other in violating the Constitution. Madison actually points this out in 1800 in the resolutions, that the court is equally culpable of violating the Constitution as the rest of the federal government, that they would be very supportive of each other in doing this. However, the question is, has the government of the United States the power to make laws on every subject? No. Does he understand it so? Can they make laws affecting the mode of transferring property or contracts or claims between citizens of the same state? No. Can they go beyond the delegated powers? No. If they, the federal government, were to make a law not warranted by any of the powers enumerated, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. They would not consider such a law coming under their jurisdiction. They would declare it void. Now, interesting, because every time, like healthcare with Obamacare, when the states went into court to say the federal government has no jurisdiction over this matter, well, guess what? The federal courts actually allowed them in, which means, and the states willingly walked into these federal courts over Obamacare, where they have no jurisdiction. There's no enumerated power. The courts can't even hear it. What the court should have done is basically when the state said, hey, we're going to court and we're not going to the federal court. We're going to make these, you know, make these determinations in our own courts. And had the federal courts come along and said, you know what, we look at the jurisdiction and you're absolutely right. We don't have any jurisdiction because this is not within the enumerated powers. And therefore, Congress has gone beyond their jurisdiction in creating laws that they have no enumerated power to authorize them to create these powers. Anyway, this is what he says. It will annihilate the state courts, says the honorable gentleman. Does not every gentleman here know that the causes in our courts are more numerous than they can decide according to their present construction? Look at the dockets. You will find them crowded with suits, which the life of man will not see determined. If some of these suits be carried to other courts, will it be wrong? They will still have business enough. Anyway, then he goes on and says, because we skip over a paragraph, how disgraceful is it that the state courts could not be trusted, says the honorable gentleman. What is the language of the Constitution? Does it take away their jurisdiction? Is it not necessary that the federal courts should have cognizance of cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States? What is the service or purpose of a judiciary but to execute the laws in a peaceably orderly manner without shedding blood or creating a contest or availing yourselves of force? If this be the case, where and its jurisdiction be more necessary than here. I get these things and it trips me up and I apologize. But I'm hoping that you actually go back and, you know, while I'm reading these, you're reading these as well. If you want, just contact me. I'll get you these documents to you so you can read these yourself. Anyway, Marshall goes on and says, to what quarter will you look for protection from an infringement on the Constitution if you will not give the power to the judiciary? There is, and when he says to what quarter, I think that actually is to what court will you look for protection from an infringement on the Constitution? Because they're talking about courts. If it will not give the power to the judiciary, there is no other body that can afford such a protection. But the honorable member objects to it because he says that the officers of the government will be screened from merited punishments by the federal judiciary. The federal sheriff, says he, will go into a poor man's house and beat him or abuse his family, and the federal court will protect him. Does any gentleman believe this? Is it necessary that the officers will commit a trespass on the property of a persons of those with whom they are to transact business? Will such great insults on the people of this country be allowable? Were a law made to authorize them, it would be void. The injured man would trust to a tribunal in his neighborhood. To such a tribunal, he would apply for redress and get it. There is no reason to fear, for that would not meet the justice there which his country will ever be willing to maintain. But on appeal, says the honorable gentleman, what chance is there to obtain justice? This is founded on an idea that they will not be impartial. There is no clause in the Constitution which bars the individual member injured from applying to the state courts to give him redress. He says that there is no instance of appeals as to fact in common law cases. The contrary is well known to you, Mr. Chairman, to be the case in this Commonwealth with respect to mills, roads, and other cases. Appeals lie from the inferior to the superior court as to fact as well as law. Is it a clear case that there can be no case in common law in which an appeal to fact might be proper and necessary? Can you not conceive a case where it would be productive of advantages to the people at large to submit to the tribunal the final determination involving facts as well as law? Suppose it would be deemed for the convenience of the citizens that those things which concerned foreign ministers should be tried in inferior courts? If justice could be done, the decision would satisfy all. But if an appeal in matters of fact could not be carried to the superior court, then it would result that such cases could not be tried before the inferior courts for the injurious and the partial decisions. And so, obviously, we're at a hard break, so we will come back to the last paragraph of what Mr. Marshall has to say on this, and then we'll get into Mr. Grayson. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so actually, I looked ahead. We may be done today. How does that sound? Anyway, and then we can do a wrap-up in the next episode, but we'll probably get in and dive into some things. Like I told you, there's some personal stuff that I need to apprise you of. And so, anywho, let's move on so that we can get through this and possibly can wrap this up today. But sir, where is the necessity of discriminating between the three cases of chancery, admiralty, and common law? Why not leave it to Congress? Will it enlarge their powers? Is it necessary for them wantonly to infringe your rights? Have you anything to apprehend when they can, in no case, abuse their power without rendering themselves hateful to the people at large? When this is the case, something may be left to the legislature freely chosen by ourselves from among ourselves, who are to share the burdens imposed upon the community and who can be changed at our pleasure. Where power may be trusted and there is no motive to abuse it, it seems to me to be as well to leave it undetermined as to fix it in the Constitution by amending the Constitution. Now, Mr. Grayson kind of pipes up and he says, There is to be one Supreme Court for Chancery, Admiralty, Common Pleas, and Exchequer. And I don't know. I'm pretty sure that's Exchequer, Exchequer, which kind of sounds French. But anyway, which great eases are left in England to four great courts? And he just basically listed four: Chancery, Admiralty, Common Pleas, and Exchequer, to which are added criminal jurisdictions and all cases depending on the law of nations. A most extensive jurisdiction. This court has more power than any court under heaven. One set of judges ought not to have this power, and judges particular who have temptation always before their eyes. The court thus organized are to execute laws made by 13 nations, dissimilar in their customs, manners, laws, and interests. Because he's talking about, literally, in the Union, each state is independent and sovereign, being able to make their own laws. But there is the necessity of reciprocity and so forth. And so there is a need to have some commonality. But anyway, the court thus organized are to execute laws made by 13 nations, dissimilar in their customs, manners, laws, and interests. If we advert to the customs of these different sovereignties, we shall find them repugnant and dissimilar. Yet they are all forced to unite and concur in making these laws. They are to form them on one principle and one idea, whether the civil law, common law, or law of nations. The gentleman was driven the other day to the expedient of acknowledging the necessity of having 13 different tax laws. This destroys the principle that he who lays a tax should feel it and bear his proportion of it. This has not been answered. It will involve consequences so absurd that I presume they will not attempt to make 13 different codes. They will be obliged to make one code. How will they make one code without being contradictory to some of the laws of the different states? So there you go. Anyway, he was bringing up this point, and actually Governor Randolph responds and kind of, you know, responds to this point. But what we want to do, and we want to wrap these up, the last two comments that we have are regarding the commissions and treaties and so forth. And so this is Mr. Monroe, and this is Mr. Monroe. So, by the way, I want you to know a little backstory or a little fact that you may not know. When the Constitutional Convention was getting ready to be formed by the states, before they identified who the delegates were, Mr. Monroe was hoping to be a representative of Virginia at the Constitutional Convention. And his feelings got hurt that James Madison was the one that went instead of him. And later on, Monroe got seconded again by James Madison, because James Madison and Monroe competed for the same position for the House of Representatives. And that was set up by Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry basically pit Monroe against Madison, and Madison ended up winning. And here's a little side note. You'd think that these guys, because they were competing all the time, they'd be mortal enemies. But these guys were really good, close friends. Anyway, because who was Madison's Secretary of State? James Monroe. So, and there's definitely a close relationship between Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and James Madison. So anyway, this is Mr. Monroe, and he basically goes off and says he could not conceive that a conditional ratification would, in the most remote degree, endanger the Union, for that it was clearly the interest of adopting states to be united with Virginia, as it could be in her interest to be in a union with them. He demanded if they would arm the states against one another and make themselves enemies of those who are respectable and powerful from their situation and numbers. he had no doubt that they would, in preference to his disparate and violent measure, come forward and make a proposition to the other states so as it would be consistent with the general interest. Adopt it now unconditionally, says he, and it will never be amended. Not even the experience shall have proved its defects. Now, remember, what he's talking about is he's talking about trying not to get the, because this is towards the very end. This is before they actually vote. And so he's pointing out, you know, hey, if we amend this, we will not get the amendments that we need. He's basically doing Patrick Henry's bidding. And he comes right out and says, if we adopt this, then they're not going to make, like he says, it will never be amended, not even when experience shall have proved its defects. An alteration will be a diminution of their power, and there will be great exertions made to prevent it. I have no dread that they will immediately infringe the dearest rights of the people, but the operation of government will be oppressive in process of time. Shall we not pursue the dictates of common sense and the example of all free and wise nations and insist on amendments with manly fortitude? Interesting, right? Here he's saying that they're not going to put these amendments in, but they want to demand these and make a contingent. Again, this was something that they did at the very beginning of this, of the convention of the ratification for Virginia. So, obviously, Patrick Henry is pulling the strings and getting James Monroe kind of engaged. And you know what? James Monroe was, I'll just say, bamboozled by Patrick Henry, because Patrick Henry, as long as James Monroe would do his bidding, Patrick Henry was helping James Monroe, because he was trying to, you know, get this guy whose feelings were hurt into Congress. He was throwing him all of these bones. Anyway, Monroe goes on and says, it is urged that there is an impossibility of getting previous amendments and that a variety of circumstances concur to render it impracticable. This argument appears to me fallacious and as a specious invasion. The same cause which has hitherto produced a spirit of unanimity and a predilection for the Union will hereafter produce the same effects. How did the Federal Convention meet? From the beginning time in any age of country, did ever men meet under so loose, uncurbed a commission? He's pointing and poking at the commission, saying, you know, when these guys went there, did they have that, you know, that loose of latitude? There was nothing to restrain them but their characters and reputation. They could not organize a system without defects. This cannot then be perfect. Is it presumable that by subsequent attempts we shall make it more complete and perfect? Is trying to get another convention to go down this path to try to redo what they're doing. What are the great objections now made? Are they local? What are the amendments brought forth by my friends? Do they not contemplate the great interests of the people and of the Union? I am satisfied from what I have seen of the disposition of the other states that instead of disunion and national confusion, there will be harmony and perfect concord. Disunion is more to be apprehended from the adoption of a system reprobated by some and allowed by all to be defective. The arguments of gentlemen have no weight on my mind. It is unnecessary to enter into the refutation of them. My honorable friends have done it highly to my satisfaction. Permit me only to observe with respect to those amendments that they are harmless. Do they change a feature of the Constitution? They secure our rights without altering a single feature. I trust, therefore, the gentlemen will concur with them. So he's trying to get them to, you know, pitch another convention to let them rewrite or go back to the Articles of Confederation, maybe patch them, which would never happen. We'll be right back after these next two promos. Thank you so much. I have been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, I will tell you that as you start reading the ratification debates, you're going to go, wow, GR, you need to read this other stuff. You know, I have to look at economy of time. I mean, I do have a show to kind of do on an annual cycle, which if I read the ratification debates, it would take me more than a year probably just to get it in 1 hour at a time. In addition to all of the editorializing and, you know, back information and those types of things to just make it really hard to be succinct and concise and just getting through this. I'm not trying to create just an audiobook. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to prove to you that the Constitution was defined very tightly, that in the ratification debates, they laid out exactly what the federal government could do, and that the states were superior in all things not delegated. Now, after Monroe had basically said, hey, you know, we shouldn't accept this. We need to go into another convention and, you know, look at making, you know, taking this and making the changes and then proposing that. Now, I'm here to tell you that Patrick Henry and those people who were trying to go down that path, Madison knew and everybody else knew that this was a desperate attempt by the states to try to retain their power. In so doing, they would be able to maintain their fiefdoms, and the demise of the Union as well as these independent sovereign states would literally come to, or the demise would rapidly come as France goes into its revolution and changes hands and basically becomes the tool or the footstool of Napoleon Bonaparte, who would then come to the United States and take everything and then expand his kingdom into the New World. Anyway, this is Mr. Ennis, who's for the most part been kind of quiet through the ratification debates. And anyway, this is what he says. How are we to decide this question? Shall we take the system by way of subsequent amendments or propose amendments as to the previous condition of our adoption? Let us consider this question coolly. In my humble opinion, it transcends the power of this convention to take it with the previous amendments. If you take it so, I say you transcend and violate the commission of the people. For if it be taken with amendments, the opinions of the people at large ought to be consulted on them. Have they an opportunity of considering previous amendments? They have seen the Constitution and sent us hither to adopt or reject it. Have we more latitude on this subject? If you propose previous amendments as the condition of your adoption, then they may radically change the paper on the table, and the people will be bound by what they know not. Subsequent amendments would not have that effect. They would not operate till the people had an opportunity of considering and altering them, if they thought proper. They could have it in their power to give contrary directions to the members of Congress. But I observe with regret that there is a general spirit of jealousy with respect to our northern brethren. Had we this political jealousy in 1775? If we had it would have dampened and or ardor and intrepidity and prevented that unanimous resistance which enabled us to triumph over the enemies. It was not a Virginian, Carolinian, or Pennsylvanian, but the glorious name of an American that extended from one end of the continent to the other. That was then beloved and confided in. Did we then expect that, in cases of success, we should be armed against one another? I would have submitted to British tyranny rather than to Northern tyranny, and what we have been told can be true, that we had no part of that philanthropic spirit which cherishes fraternal affection, unites friends, enables them to achieve the most gallant exploits, and renders them formidable to other nations. And so there he kind of goes into talking about the importance of the Union itself, and even more so, the importance of ratifying and then providing amendments after the fact or subsequent so that the people can actually have say on it. What has been on the table, what was just presented actually, was let's amend this now so that we can actually go and then we'll ratify this based on how we amend it. I mean, that was actually a very radical consideration. And as Mr. Ennis absolutely points out, that the people who have not seen these changes would now be bound by this new form of government that they sent delegates to ratify in an original context, not in a changed context. The interesting thing, as we go through the ratification debates, how they define what these words mean and how the government is supposed to act and behave and its limitations and all of these things, as we look at this, what we're actually seeing is basically legal definitions, terms, and appendages to the Constitution. That's how we have to look at the ratification debates and the Federalists who were, you know, involved in this overall process. Now, Mr. Ennis also says this, but we are told that we need not be afraid of Great Britain. Will that great and warlike, that vindictive nation lose the desire of revenging her losses and disgraces? Will she passively look flagrant violations of the treaty? Will she lose the desire of retrieving those laurels which are buried in America? Should I transfuse into the breast of a Briton that arme patrice, or amor patrice, which is so strong, predominates in my own land, in my own, he would say, while I have a guinea, I shall give it to recover a lost America. And with that, my friends, that is the last of the highlights that we have for you for the ratification debates. And so as we kind of look at this, and I've got 3.5 minutes. So I'll try to give you kind of an overview of where we've been and what we've kind of done here. When we started, we really started with this concept of the scale of liberty, the ideological sides of liberty and subjugation. And when you look at government and government control and thiefdom, that is the portal. That is that the threshold of moving from liberty to subjugation. Because as long as you allow ultimate power and general powers to persist, government will continue to assume more and more power and take control of every facet of your life. This is why it is our responsibility and it's our duty to not only get the federal government into check with this brilliant, this genius constitution, we have to look at the states, and we must look at the states' constitutions so that we clarify what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional, identify any general powers, and change them to become enumerated powers without general intent and purposes. What ends up happening when you give general powers to the government? It becomes to their discretion to rule you as they wish, to their whims. And we can't allow that to happen. Now, when we looked at the Constitutional Convention and how things move forward, it was just a miracle that these men were able to go through such. If you just look at the Electoral College and the election of the president and that whole process and the arguments and the debates, if I remember correctly, the choosing of the president went through changes 60 times during the convention. So, I mean, they exerted a lot of time and energy and thought in arguing all of these different processes to try to come up with what was the best. In many cases, they did. And in some cases, they may have missed something here or there. But over time, they've been able to change and or affect those deficiencies with amendments such as the 11th Amendment, the 12th Amendment, and so forth. Now, as the Constitution was finally signed, the drama began. George Mason lifted up his right arm and said, "I would rather cut my arm off than sign that document without a Bill of Rights." And so the drama began, and everybody started making this hay, political hay, out of the fact that, or tried to make political hay out of the fact that the Constitution did not have a Bill of Rights. Well, that argument was lost in the convention as well as the ratification debates because they didn't include a Bill of Rights, and Mason wanted to see that Bill of Rights in the convention. The fact is that what they created was an enumerated constitution listing the powers to be this and this alone. And by going down that path, they really denned the federal government into these very specific corners so that they couldn't take latitude, so that it wasn't their discretion of how they were to rule us and control us. They were tied to very specific powers and only those powers. As you know, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. takeaction.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.